These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by the Teaching Company. These lectures are titled Classics of British Literature, Part 4. Lecture 37, Eliot, Fiction and Moral Reflection.
The subject of the lecture, this lecture, is George Eliot's novel Middlemarch. It is, Virginia Woolf famously declared, the first novel in English for grown-ups. Now, Woolf did not mean, of course, what later generations would understand by the term adult fiction. What she meant was fiction or a novel for morally mature people. Also, in the 30-odd years which separate Middlemarch from Oliver Twist, which we looked at, the novel has come a long way. In Oliver Twist, Dickens called on melodrama, sentimentality, to almost, as it were, coerce the reader into certain kinds of emotional response. Dickens also felt the need to tie every thread together. Nothing must be left hanging. And this leads, of course, inevitably to certain improbabilities. I mean, you'd think that everyone in London was somehow related to or connected with the hero. George Eliot has brought, and or at least she's come at a time when she's helped bring, the novel beyond that. The novel can dare to be, as it were, to have loose ends, to as it were, to be as messy in many ways as life is. Now, to go back to that praise of Virginia Woolf's, the first novel for grown-ups in English, it's very high praise to live up to. Henry James was perhaps less flattering when he lumped Middlemarch together with other fiction leviathans of the Victorian period as a great baggy monster. Wonderful phrase. Well, for ourselves, we can begin by saying that Middlemarch is all of the above. It's a great novel, and it's also a big novel in the Jamesian sense, too big perhaps, and also perhaps too big for our crazy hurried times. That we perhaps rather, as it were, sort of blanch or sort of recoil from the idea of reading a novel which is 800 pages long. It's very loose-knit. The narrative, I began by saying, is not as tightly compressed, as artificially compressed as one would get in Dickens. But that loose-knittedness means that sometimes it falls apart, almost falls apart. It strains at the edges. Now, there is, in fact, a genetic reason for this. The manuscripts of Middlemarch indicate that it began as two separate novels which were fused at a quite late stage of conception into the author's magnum opus, maximum opus, we can say. It's very large. I'll say a bit more about the doubleness, the duplicity, the two yoked egg aspect of Middlemarch later on. First of all, who wrote it? And that's something of a catch question, because on the title page we read Middlemarch, A Study of Provincial Life, published initially in 8 bi-monthly serial parts over the years 1871 to 1872 by the publisher John Blackwood, and subsequently as 4 massive volumes. And the author is listed on that title page, those title pages, of course, as George Eliot. But this George Eliot never existed in the real world. It's a pen name, a male pseudonym for a remarkable woman writer, Marianne Evans, as she was born. Why did Marianne Evans, a female chauvinist, if there ever was one, right behind the protection of a male mask? One can almost imagine a beard on that kind of imaginary George Eliot. When her novels first came out, most readers assumed the author was male. That's not a mistake one would have made, I think, with Ellis Bell and Wuthering Heights, or even Currer Bell and Jane Eyre more so. As soon as one hears that voice in the mind, one hears a woman author. Indeed, one opportunistic fellow called Liggins caused George Eliot / Marian Evans immense chagrin by claiming that he was the mysterious author of Middlemarch, or not of an earlier novel, in fact, Adam Bede. Now, the reason for this changing of gender is complicated and ultimately, I think, rather enigmatic. The most intellectually forceful of novelists, George Eliot, I'm going to call her that from now on, did not want to be associated with the troupe of what she called, memorably, silly novels by lady novelists, women's romance, that is. She wanted to write, and indeed did write, fiction of ideas, those ideas that were making and reshaping Victorian society and culture. Now, it may be that she was also inspired in her choice of name, George Eliot, by the great French blue-stocking novelist Georges Sand, George Sand, as if one wants to anglicise the pronunciation. Possibly even she was inspired by Charlotte Bronte, who chose to launch herself, as we saw, in the world of literature as the male-sounding Carabelle. Springing as she did from a rural, provincial, evangelical background, the Midlands town called Middlemarch in the novel, the area around Coventry in real geography, Miss Evans did not want to cause embarrassment to family members who, like many of their community, their evangelical community, had suspicions about fiction and thought novel writers were scandalous bohemians, like that naughty Mr. Dickens, for instance, who threw his wife out after she born the brute 10 children, and then, this is Dickens, picked up with an actress half his age, Ellen Ternan. It may be that she was, as it were, sort of reluctant to embarrass relatives, but whatever the motive, it was as George Eliot that Marian Evans came on the scene with her first works in the 1850s, and it was as George Eliot that she enjoyed her first runaway success with writing fiction. And it is as George Eliot that posterity reads and admires and enshrines her in the pantheon of great writers. But ask yourself, in the following short quotation from Middlemarch, do you hear in your mind's ear a man's or a woman's voice? I'll read it twice, doing it, as Dickens would say, in different voices. If we had a keen vision and feeling of all ordinary human life, it would be like hearing the grass grow and the squirrel's heart beat, and we should die of that roar which lies on the other side of silence. As it is, the best of us walk around well wadded with stupidity. That's my ultra-masculine voice. Now let me just try and do it falsetto in my imitation of what might be thought female inflection. If we had a keen vision and feeling of all ordinary human life, it would be like hearing the grass grow and the squirrel's heart beat, and we should die of that roar which lies on the other side of silence. As it is, the best of us walk round, well wadded with stupidity. I hear a man's voice. That may be my own sort of predisposition. Whatever, it's a wonderful observation, loaded with unforgettable epigram. Once heard, no one ever forgets the phrase, that roar which lies on the other side of silence. And the authority in that authorial voice, what gender does it belong to, male baritone or female contralto? Oh, let's compromise. It's supergendered. It's, if you like, the voice of God, or a novelist who thinks she's God, as detractors of Eliot like to sneer. She had plenty of detractors. Eliot's background was extraordinary, admirable, and if one is thinking in terms of the usual hand-me-down conventions, wholly un-Victorian. She was non-conformist to the core. Least of all did she conform to the historical age into which she was born and which, in Middlemarch, she examines with an intelligence which, you know, resent her moral authoritarianism or not, puts her in a class of her own. She's not merely clever. George Eliot is a philosopher novelist, the articulate prophet of what she called the religion of humanity. A moral code which would fill that hole where in less knowledgeable eras, previous eras, simple religious formulae used to be adequate. They're no longer adequate in the modern world that she was living in and writing about. Novels, Eliot firmly believed, could, like religion, make us better people, and they were necessary. Now, how they did this, she was interestingly specific about. Fiction, she believed, has the power to dissolve egotism and make us more sympathetic or altruistic to our fellow human beings. Novels make us realise that other people have what George Eliot called an equivalent centre of self. Put another way, you're as important to you as I am important to me. Now, anyone who's brought up children knows that it's an extremely hard lesson to get across, and for many it never gets across at all. In Middlemarch, Eliot uses a striking and strikingly highbrow image to picture the egoism which conditions our view of the world, our wadding of stupidity, as she called it in that earlier quotation. This, remember, is from a novel. It doesn't actually sort of get the novel galloping away in narrative terms, but it is very important to George Eliot's vision, which underlies the novel. An eminent philosopher among my friends, who can dignify even your ugly furniture by lifting it into the serene light of science, has shown me this pregnant little fact. Your pier glass, that's a looking glass, or extensive surface of polished steel made to be rubbed by a housemaid, will be minutely and multitudinously scratched in all directions. But place now against it a lighted candle as a centre of illumination, and lo, the scratches will seem to arrange themselves in a fine series of concentric circles round that little sun, the candle. It is demonstrable that the scratches are going everywhere impartially, and it is only your candle which produces the flattering illusion of a concentric arrangement, its lights falling with an exclusive optical selection. That's pretty highbrow stuff. These things are a parable, she uses the biblical analogy. The scratches are events, and the candle is the egoism of any person now absent, of Miss Vincey, for example. The narrative then goes on to describe how recent difficulties in her marital life, which are going in all sorts of different directions, are selfishly viewed by Rosamund Vincey. She is the centre of her universe. Rosamund never, she's a very limited character in the novel, Rosamund never ever gets that lesson about equivalent centres of self that I was referring to earlier. Fiction, then, has a higher mission than mere entertainment for George Eliot. Nor was she averse to making her readers work hard. Optical selection? What's that? In the above passage, I dare say, one has to think more concentratedly than you would with any kind of passage of reflection, moral reflection, from, say, the great clubman Thackeray or the great showman Charles Dickens. Not, of course, and I stress this, not that they're lesser novelists, but they demand less of the reader than George Eliot does. Let's look a little at the background of this remarkable writer, George Eliot. She was born, say, Marian Evans, in 1819 in the rural Midlands of England. She was brought up in the environs of Coventry, Warwickshire, Middlemarch country. Her father, whom she idolised, but whose strict Christianity she could not subscribe to eventually, was a steward or an estate manager. It was an exquisitely painful but intellectually necessary moment in Marianne's adolescence when, to her father's grief, she declared she could no longer accompany him to Sunday service. That, if you like, was her non-serviam, I will not serve. She gives an idealised portrait of her father, whom she continued to love, as Caleb Garth in Middlemarch. Young Marianne read avidly. Her father's position gave her access to a good library, and there was an active, self-improving intellectual life in the nonconformist communities of provincial towns like Coventry, where she was brought up, a kind of salon culture. The nonconformist, low Anglicanism in which Eliot was born was less prejudiced than society at large to women learning things. And she learned. Did she learn? Eliot became the leading woman intellectual of her time, but she was largely self-taught and introduced to higher learning by congenial friends. She taught herself foreign languages, think how difficult that is, and entered into the theological disputes of the time, notably what was called higher criticism, or the theory that the Bible was not literally but metaphorically true. Jonah was not swallowed up and disgorged by a whale, something zoologically impossible. It is a metaphor for the captivity and release of Israel from bondage. Now, one had to read through, not just in, important texts. Now, Eliot brought this, of course, to her writing of fiction. Eliot was introduced by friends to the writings of such contemporary sages as Herbert Spencer, Thomas Carlyle, Harriet Martineau, and Ralph Waldo Emerson. On her father's death, Eliot embarked on her career. And fiction was not then in prospect for her. She was aiming higher than that. Her first major literary effort was the translation from the German of David Strauss's Life of Jesus, a classic text of the higher criticism I've just been talking about. Eliot moved, necessarily, to London, because that's where all the important things were happening culturally, and she became a leading light in the capital's higher journalism, not easy to do if you're a woman at this time. In critical writings over this period, she formulated what we may call her philosophy. It was strongly influenced by the work of the pioneer of sociology, the French philosopher Auguste Comte. Now, essentially, Comteism believed that society progressed through stages from primitivism to a scientific organization of itself. But that final, or as he saw it, third stage, could be morally conditioned, even though it would have transcended or gone beyond religion. There would be something to replace the religion which had been lost in earlier stages of evolution or development. Now, so much for Comteism. Eliot, to apply labels, was a free thinker, but also, throughout her life, a stern moralist. Her thought on such matters, her thinking on such matters, was strongly influenced by the man whom she chose to live with. It's very much her choice, George Henry Lewes. Now, like her, Lewes was a leading light in London's higher journalism. He was a popularizer of science, an editor, and a Comtean. He was also a married man who, true to his free-thinking philosophy, had no objection to his wife and the mother of his children deciding that she preferred to live with another man. And he allowed her to do so. It was a moral decision. This was the mid-1850s, a no-divorce period, as Dickens, who also had his wife problems in the mid-1850s, makes clear in his novel Hard Times. Divorce was only possible, believe it or not, by an act of Parliament. Individual divorce, that's to say, you want to get divorced, you had to get Parliament to agree with that. Now, George Eliot and George Lewes became what we would call partners for life. It was a marriage of minds and of bodies. Eliot was 35 years old at the time. There would be no children. Free thinkers as they were, the two Georges, George Lewes and George Eliot, probably used contraception. In 1857, Eliot, at Lewes's suggestion, embarked on fiction with some short stories. Scenes of Clerical Life, they were called. And they were published in Blackwood's magazine, and they were encouragingly successful. They were very well received. She went on to publish a long novel, Adam Bede, which came out in 1859 in three volumes. Set at the turn of the 18th and 19th century, she's writing, remember, in the middle of the 19th century, the setting of Adam Bede was the Methodist revival, that evangelism which would vitalize and morally reform the country over the next 100 years. That's what she was interested in, the ideologies which made Victorianism. It was hugely successful, not least because everyone wondered, who could the author of this wonderful work be? It's a kind of very powerful novel, not just in the quality of the thinking. It also had a good story. Funny enough, it's about a very strong country fellow, a carpenter, who is in love, and the woman he loves, Hetty Sorrel, is seduced by the squire of the manor where they're living in the Midlands. It's the turn of the century, as I say, and this destroys Adam Bede's world. His sense of hierarchy is destroyed by losing the woman he loves to the squire. He idolizes the squire, but he loves the woman. And so, in fact, he becomes, as it were, susceptible to reforming influences, which come to him from another woman, Dinah, who's a Methodist preacher. It's a novel which has a very powerful storyline. It ends with a near hanging. Hetty kills the child which she's born, her seducer, and is almost hanged at the gallows and saved at the 11th hour. It has a good story to it, but it is the quality, as I say, of thought, the philosophical dimension, which makes it as powerful and as rereadable today as it is. Now, over the next few years, George Eliot would go on to write other great novels, Middlemarch, Felix Holt the Radical, a study of early trade unionism and of proletarian revolt, Romola, a historical novel set in the Florence of the time of the fierce moralist Savonarola. And for this novel, incidentally, Eliot received the largest payment any English novelist had hitherto had, £10,000. It translates into millions. And finally, her last great novel, Daniel Deronda, a complex study of marriage, morality, and Zionism. It's kind of strange brew. Zionism had never been dealt with. The question of the Jews in England had never been dealt with as sensitively and as perceptively as George Eliot did in that last great novel. Typically, I mean, George Eliot being George Eliot, took lessons in Hebrew to prepare herself for this novel from London's senior rabbi. That's the kind of author she was. Eliot never married Lewis, who died before her. She did, however, in later life, marry a younger disciple, 20 years her junior. It was, after a rather rocky honeymoon, a happy marriage. She died prematurely in 1880, having written no fiction after Lewis's death and devoting herself instead to putting his papers in order. She was denied the place she merited in Westminster Abbey, being too immoral for that place, had she not lived in sin with George Henry Lewis. History, of course, has recognised her as one of the greatest moralists in English literary history. She's buried in Highgate Cemetery, in that area which is reserved for religious dissenters, next to George Henry Lewis, the man whom she loved. That place, the home of English intellectualism, Hampstead, has no objections to the couple sharing their last bed, one is glad to say. Now, I want to devote what remains of this lecture to the masterpiece hailed by Woolf, Middlemarch. You'll note it's named not after a hero or a heroine, but a place. An imaginary town, based, as I say, quite clearly on Coventry, in the late 1820s, early 1830s. Why that period? Because it's the period just before the first Reform Bill. Reform is, as will be clear, Eliot's great theme. How do you make society better? That's her big question. To cut to her conclusion, not by passing bills emancipating voters in Parliament, not allowing them to vote, but by not by legislation, but by making people better. And that, as the novel suggests, is very tricky. How do you make people better? How do you reform people? You forget reforming the law. It's a vast canvas that she has in Middlemarch. There are many strands of plot and subplot and a huge dramatis personae. But there are two main plot lines, and this goes back, as I say, to the fact that she thought of it initially as two novels. One follows a young medical scientist called Lydgate. He's brilliant and intends to revolutionise his discipline. He fails when he fatally chooses an unworthy partner. That was the Rosamund Vincey mentioned earlier. She's beautiful, but she's vacuous, selfish, egotistic, and ultimately destructive of his idealism. Now, the other plot line is centred on Dorothea Brooke, a young idealist. Dorothea dreams of being a helpmeet to genius. She wants to be one of Milton's daughters. She wants to subordinate herself, but nonetheless do something very important in life. Like Mary Wollstonecraft, she wants to do more with her God-given talents than merely be a respectable 19th-century woman, wife and mother. She is, Eliot stresses this word, ardent, ablaze with idealism. Disastrously, Dorothea identifies as the man of genius, the Milton, to whom she will dedicate her life, Edward Casaubon. This, in fact, is the man to whom she will be helpmeet. Now, Casaubon is a desiccated scholar whose great project is as intellectually sterile as he is himself personally. Dorothea sees herself as a latter-day St. Teresa, a woman who will change the world. Alas, on her honeymoon in Rome, the Eternal City, surrounded by the same ruins as Edward Gibbon was inspired by, she realises her terrible mistake. She's thrown her life away. This is the scene I want to look at. Remember, as I read it, that novels, particularly those silly novels by lady novelists that George Eliot so despised, typically end with a happy marriage. This novel, Middlemarch, is effectively beginning from that point. Not a happy marriage, but a very unhappy marriage. This is Dorothea waking up, or not waking up, but coming to consciousness of the failure of her marriage on her wedding trip, her extended honeymoon. 2 hours later, Casaubon has just gone off to the catacombs to pursue his research. Very symbolic that he should go to a house of the dead. 2 hours later, Dorothea was seated in an inner room or boudoir of a handsome apartment in the Via Sistina. I am sorry to add that she was sobbing bitterly. Yet Dorothea had no distinctly shaven grievance that she could state even to herself, and in the midst of her confused thought and passion, the mental act that was struggling forth into clearness was a self-accusing cry that her feeling of desolation was the fault of her own spiritual poverty. Typically, she blames herself. She had married the man of her choice, and with the advantage over most girls, that she had contemplated her marriage chiefly as the beginning of new duties. From the very first, she thought of Mr. Casaubon as having a mind so much above her own that he must often be claimed by studies which she could not entirely share. Moreover, after the brief, narrow experience of her girlhood, she was beholding Rome, the city of visible history, where the past of a whole hemisphere seems moving in funeral procession with strange ancestral images and trophies gathered from afar. But this stupendous fragmentariness heightened the dreamlike strangeness of her bridal life. She's distraught. A recent critic has suggestively compared the traumatized condition of Dorothea, as she's here described, to the dreamlike strangeness that rape victims report. Dorothea, that is, has experienced something that feels like violation. Now, there's a great deal of speculation about what's actually gone on in the honeymoon, but the point is, you know, whether or not it was consummated. But the point is, Dorothea is destroyed. But here is where the novel gets complicated and fascinating. That destruction of her ardent idealism is a necessary step to growth, rebirth, and eventually, after many trials and much suffering, to regeneration and fulfillment. Life as Eliot sees it, and I think we can take this right the way back to her early nonconformity, is very hard. At the end of her life, Dorothea, who's been widowed and is now happily remarried to another man, realizes that she was never meant to be a St. Teresa of the 19th century. The 19th century has no room for St. Teresas. It's too crowded, it's too bureaucratic, it's too complicated. And I want to finish with the wonderful final sentences of this greatest of novels, because you remember I said at the beginning that we've come a long way from Dickens. Not that Dickens wasn't a great novelist, but Dickens would never not have ended his novels happily. Never not have ended his novels with everything, to some extent, coming together so that we, as it were, walk away feeling, as it were, sort of all's well in the world. George Eliot was too honest to take that easy route, to as it were, sign off in that easy way. This is how she described, and the novel at the end concentrates specifically and very closely on Dorothea. She is now, as it were, the centre of the novel's action throughout, as we realise. The novel ends with the rest of Dorothea's life, and it's a beautifully sort of measured and mixed sort of response that description of how Dorothea's life will go on from here elicits in the reader. Certainly, concludes George Eliot, those determining acts of her life were not ideally beautiful. They were the mixed result of young and noble impulse, struggling amidst the conditions of an imperfect social state, in which great feelings will often take the aspect of error and great faith the aspect of illusion. For there is no creature whose inward being is so strong that it is not greatly determined by what lies outside it. A new Teresa will hardly have the opportunity of reforming a conventual life any more than a new Antigone will spend her heroic piety in daring all for the sake of a brother's burial. The medium in which their ardent deeds took shape is forever gone. But we insignificant people, with our daily words and acts, are preparing the lives of many Dorotheas, some of which may present a far sadder sacrifice than that of the Dorothea whose story we know. Her finely touched spirit had still its fine issues, though they were not widely visible. Her full nature, like that river of which Cyrus broke the strength, spent itself in channels which had no great name on the earth, but the effect of her being on those around her was incalculably diffusive. For the growing good of the world is partly dependent on unhistoric acts, and that things are not so ill with you and me, as they might have been, is half owing to the number who lived faithfully a hidden life and rest in unvisited tombs. There are pilgrims that go to the tomb of St. Teresa, but no one will go to the tomb of Dorothea Ladislaw, as she is when she is finally buried. It's a wonderful ending, as I say, because it leaves us unsatisfied. We want Dorothea, as it were, we want our happy ever after. But George Eliot will not give us that. Why will she not give it to us? The reason she won't give it to us is because life is not like that. It seems to me that what George Eliot has done is taken realism, that innovation which Jane Austen introduced. She in fact read Jane Austen very carefully. She takes that realism and she takes it to its furthest extent, as far as it can go. It's very difficult. Reading that passage aloud, I felt, you know, I had to think as I was reading that. I think I could almost sort of say it by heart. She demands, as I say, a lot of the reader. But on the other hand, she gives so much back to the reader. This, in fact, is a great novel, and it seems to me it would be impertinent to deny that it does not, if we read it as it deserves to be read, that it does not make us greater than we were than when we turned the first pages of Middlemarch, A Story of Provincial Life.